I wandered down here and saw the light shining from under your door. At first, seeing her as a relief from Daniel's intensity, but then I realized that she's glaring at me.
You shouldn't be drinking, she adds. I've been downstairs, but I wasn't drinking.
As perceptive as Leela is, she often ignores my little white lies. I stare into the door lock, and it clicks open.
Can I come in for a bit? She asks.
I glance at the time, and then I look at her, nibbling at the skin of her thumb.
Can we talk in the morning before I go in?
I just need to know if you're all right.
She looks at me intently for a few seconds, her head cocked to one side.
I'm fine, if you are.
I take her by the shoulders.
I'm all right, Leela. I'm fine.
She pulls me into a hug.
I'm sorry for what you're going through.
Her voice is warm and muffled in the hollow of my neck.
They killed Sarah while she was making dinner,
I whisper after a few seconds. Daniel said she would have been in a lot of pain. Leela pulls away from me, clasping her hands to my shoulders.
Is that who you were with? What's his game telling you things like that?
I shrug. She sighs.
I'm sorry I couldn't be there for the last procedure, she says.
They told me there's too much going on now that I'd get in the way.
I know.
I'll ask Maya again if you like tomorrow. She might change her mind, I say.
I reach out and flick away the last particles of mascara from underneath her eye. I should tell her that I do wish she could be there, that she makes me feel stronger simply by her presence in a room. But I don't. Partly because I need to reassure her that I'll be fine. Partly because it's easier not to.
Go on, I say.
Get a good night's sleep, and I'll see you in the morning. The next procedure is in a matter of hours. Which is exactly why you shouldn't be drinking whiskey.
I sigh and turn my head away, gazing down the empty corridor. She stares at me, her expression unreadable.
What changed, Isabel?
I look back at her, and I feel the honesty between us, the complete acceptance of each other. 10 years of friendship, and she has always understood me. I hesitate, searching for the true answer, for the reason I turned my perfectly ordered life upside down. I found somebody who believed in me. Her face tips forward, her lips downturned.
Night, Izzy.
She blows me a kiss and turns away. It's only as I look at the slope of her shoulders as she retreats down the corridor that I realize that what I said has hurt her. She has always believed in me. I close the door and stumble out of my clothes, leaving a trail of them behind me. I'm fuzzy with alcohol and, I suppose, the remnants of anesthetic. I manage to work a toothbrush around my teeth without turning on the bathroom light. For once, I ignore the bottle of mineral water and drop my head into the sink, letting the tap fill my mouth before swilling and spitting. I crawl into bed and lie awake for a few minutes, flat on my back. I imagine Jess packing for the trip and think about the runaway train I've put into motion. It is gathering speed. In 8 hours, my body will be forced into a coma while my heaven, the memories and hopes and dreams I've worked on day and night for the past weeks, will be activated. And then my consciousness will meet Yarrick's consciousness. We'll be together again in a way that I can't yet conceive. It should work. But even if nothing goes wrong, it will still feel a little bit like dying. Chapter 22. The previous times I've launched myself off this precipice and into the chasm that awaits, I felt quite calm. It's a case in point that I've never thought in terms as dramatic as that analogy before. But today, my nerves are fizzing in my extremities. My stomach is complaining of hunger. Even having Jess here doesn't seem to have helped. She is shaving away patches of my hair with a silent dignity that asks me to trust her. Her cool fingertips press lightly into my skull and the skin of my face. "I'll ask you one last time," she whispers, her voice hovering somewhere above the top of my head. "Are you sure?" I stare into the white cotton of her lab coat and remain silent. She takes her hands from me and stands back, crouching to look at me. Her eyes are calm grey pools. Her dark hair is scraped back from her face so that it almost looks straight, and I notice for the first time silvery white hairs springing out from the severe center parting. Perhaps she's older than I thought. She gives me time. She waits with a patience that I'd like to test. I blink back at her. "I know it's important we get this right, but I'll try to keep it as short as possible, Izzy," she says. She moves around me, checking wires and displays, and pushing the bedside table away in order to tuck the drip alongside me. I feel her fingers catch on the dips between my ribs. "I'm aware you haven't been eating well." Like Leela, she is always finding new ways to tell me off. Jess inclines her head in the direction of the anaesthetist. It's a man today. He has a kinder face than the woman he replaces. He approaches and runs a smooth finger over the inside of my arm, feeling for the vein and deciding where to place the new anaesthetic tattoo. "How long?" I murmur, running my eyes over Leela, Daniel, and Maya, who were all standing at the back of the room. Maya agreed to let Leela in at the last moment, with a little persuasion. She had to rush down here from the hotel, so she's not wearing a scrap of makeup, and her hair isn't brushed. It makes her look younger, closer to the age she was when I met her on my first day at Oakley Associates. That was years ago now. I smile at her and make a little wave without lifting my hand from the bed. She waves back, her face frozen with what I assume is worry. Beside her, Daniel and Maya are turned away from me with their heads bent together. Maya is talking with a whispered ferocity accompanied by sharp hand gestures. I start to lose interest in what they might be talking about, and I'm not even sure what I've just asked Jess. "The surgery will take the most time, cutting through your skull, inserting all the probes, getting them to the right spot, and connecting up the artificial synapses. I think that will take quite a lot of fine-tuning to get right, so the prep alone could be 4, maybe 5 hours. Jess's words almost run into each other. She's talking so fast. I sense that she is nervous. "Then we'll activate your heaven and link your mirror neurons up to Yarix. And you'll have an idea quite quickly if it's working." She crouches by my side and folds her arms on the bed, level with my chest. "Yeah, hopefully, like we discussed, your consciousness will then overlay your heaven and help shape it. Your mirror neurons should quickly fill the gaps, make assumptions to tie your heavens together into a cohesive whole. It's like with vision. Our brain can fall for optical tricks and illusions because it's so keen to make a full picture. It takes shortcuts." A matter-of-fact tone fades, and the real Jess smiles gently at me. "I'll stay with you between the surgical procedures. I'll watch you." She glances over her shoulder. "Leela too." "What will happen to me?" I ask, and try to raise my arm to point at the side of my head, but it won't move. Emotions sweep through me so quickly that I can't even identify them. I feel water coating my eyes, blurring the last of my vision as they sink closed. I will do this perfectly, she says. I will make sure those synapses and neurons of yours remain unchanged. Everything will be as it should be, I promise. She pauses, and I wonder if she thinks I'm already gone. I can explain it to you, Izzy, but I can't understand it for you, she whispers. The last thing I hear as I'm going under, clutching onto reality, is what sounds like the scream of a siren. Every other sense has blackened, but my ears register it as I slip away. It crashes rhythmically into the corners of the room as they close in around me. It is the color of danger, and it smells of fear. I lie face down in the grass, breathing in the aroma of chlorophyll and feeling the sun heat the cotton shirt on my back. My sister is doing the same, and we are giggling at ourselves hysterically. My belly is full, and the birdsong is loud in the trees. Now we're collecting blackberries from the hedgerows, and I look at my hands. They are black and blue and dirty, laced with scratches, beaded with blood. Where my sister was, my cats now purr, looking out at me from within the bases of the brambles. I crouch down, and I'm in my childhood home, rolling on the rug. Olive is a kitten, and she paws at me with her pink velvet pads, her huge eyes watching my every move. I hear my sister's disembodied giggle and the rustle of damp autumn wind through a hedgerow. Juniper and Olive mew at me, asking for their dinner. Then, it all blends and blurs and sharpens into a crackle that is more tactile than noise. It tugs at me, and it feels like my body is being altered by it. I look down at the palms of my hands, and as I'm studying the lines and the bands of my rings, the edges of me shatter. A white noise thunders through me, and I remember that I can't get out. Pulling out of this too fast would be more dangerous than seeing it through. I'm screaming and laughing, and my lungs feel like they will explode. I'm spinning and falling through rooms and vehicles and sky, feeling that it should be making me sick, but it's only mentally confusing rather than physically disorienting. I'm on Yarrick's rugby field again, surrounded by mud-splattered men. A mist of sweat rises to envelop us, and I feel nothing but pure elation. My legs are strong and sturdy beneath me, and I'm running through pine trees, being chased by my kid sister. I laugh because I always win. I'm cradling a tiny baby, and she is screaming through her gummy mouth. She is pink and purple and white and hairless. It's wonderful. It's beautiful. And yet I'm weeping. We're running along a clifftop, and somehow I know that the little girl ahead of me is the same child as the baby. She glances back at me and laughs, her brown hair covering her face, and it makes my heart sing. A shadowy figure runs beside me, and I know that it's Yarrick's wife. But Yarrick has no idea who it is. He didn't want her in his heaven, but he wanted this memory. So she's there, but without identity, fading into the background. Yet there's an underlying sense of darkness that has no time or place or meaning. It makes me gag, and I close my eyes to it.
Is...
Yarrick's voice is raspy in my ear. I'm spinning into his arms and he yanks me towards him. Everything inside me feels broken and healed at the same time. But then he kisses me and the world falls silent as the pressure of his lips seems to burst my eardrums. I can't feel the paving slabs beneath my feet, but I know they are there, struggling to hold me upright as I melt into his embrace. Our first kiss. The only kiss I ever need to remember. We're in the basement safe room again. I can't look. I'm too scared that I'm imagining it. Because if he's talking to me like this, as he would have done in life, it's real. We may not be in this building, or in these bodies, or in these clothes, but our minds are real. Against all odds, it has worked. Jess is a genius.
Are you okay?
Yarick asks, and I gasp as he runs his hand over my back. Yes? It sounds like a question, I realize, because I'm not quite okay, of course I'm not. And I find myself wondering for the first time how much of my time with Yarick was spent being honest.
I'm dead, aren't I? This is my heaven.
Confusion dances across his face, and I remember that he has no idea. No idea at all. I nod my head apologetically until I realize he's grinning.
You are the best, Iz. What you've done is incredible, incredible.
He smiles, and I know with a rush of emotion that this is, without doubt, the man I love, not some figment of my imagination.
Are you dead?
He asks me, and I almost laugh, but shake it away. No. He doesn't need to ask me to explain. The questions are written all over his face. It's complicated.
Of course it is.
I expect him to grab at me playfully or latch his mouth onto my neck and trail kisses up to my ear, but he doesn't. I almost lean into him with desire. But then I find myself wondering how well Daniel and Maya can see this scene, and I hold back. I realize I haven't planned what I'm going to say at this point. I never considered that I was going to have to interrogate him. I wait for him to ask me why I'm here and how, but he doesn't. We sit facing each other, our hands in our laps. I want to be somewhere else in our heavens. I want to be free, but I know that I'm not. Did you love your wife? I stare into his eyes, half expecting him to freeze up again, but imploring him to answer me at the same time.
My wife?
He shakes his head, knitting his brows. His eyes wander, searching for something that isn't there. The memories that feature in his heaven are limited, and she is not in them, it's obvious. But Daniel's words enter my mind.
If he did something, perhaps something incredibly violent, then it's the kind of powerful memory that could be hidden in there somewhere.
Somewhere in his mirror neurons, the cells that are making it possible for us to have this conversation. You were married, Yarick. She was the mother of your children.
Oh,
he frowns.
Then why isn't she in my heaven?
I ignore his question. When you died. I choke on my words, feeling his absence anew, despite the magic that places him here, a simulation of flesh and blood in front of me. She was found dead, too. She was murdered.
Oh my God!
His mouth falls open and he stares at me, eyes wide. I find it hard to continue, but then I think of the darkness that I felt when I was experiencing his heaven. I saw it. I felt it. What feels like mere moments ago. I think of Daniel's calm, rational insistence. I think of the urgent, passionate force Yarick pressed upon me in life. Could his anger be as highly charged? And although it is half swallowed and broken, just enough doubt enters my mind to utter the words. Did you kill her?
Kill her?
He scoffs. You can tell me, I find myself saying. I just need to know. I won't tell anyone. The words slink out and disappear into the dim corners of the room.
I can't even remember having a wife, Isabel. All I remember is you.
He clings to me and kisses my ear. I note that it's the first time he's done so.
Even if I had murdered her, how would I remember it here in my heaven?
They think, I begin, and I realize that I should have said I. I scan his face but find no sign that he noticed. Your mirror neurons, the part of you that lives on in the lab, encoding your consciousness, that's what's allowing us to have this conversation. I think that some memories can be stored there too, memories with strong emotional resonance.
Like love?
He asks. Yes, like love, I reply. But also like hate. He stands up and drops his hands to his sides.
I understand what you're saying is. But don't you know that I would never have done anything like that?
Of course I do.
Then why do you even have to ask?
I shake my head. Now I'm here, I have no idea why. I'm so far away from myself that my memory is failing me. What made me agree to all of this? Was it that I wanted to see my own heaven? Was it that I wanted to see Yarrick again by any way possible? Can I really have been so blindly driven by love? Yes, yes, yes. Did I also need to see what I've spent my life dedicated to creating? Did I need to rediscover some lost belief in the ethics of my profession?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Because it's up to me to prove you didn't do it. I'm trying to find a way to demonstrate your innocence. I let him pull me up and squeeze me tightly to his chest. I feel the love permeating through my clothes, and I know from his silence that he had nothing to do with Sarah's death. He didn't kill her, and there is no memory to be found that says otherwise. He kisses my nose, and I realize that when I leave him, my job is done. I will be finished with all of this. The probes will come out of my brain, our mirror neurons will be disconnected, and that will be it. Even my heaven, when I do die, won't be able to replicate this strange reality. We won't be able to make any more moments together. We don't have a future together. All we have is old memories and beautiful lies of our own making. The panic spreads through my chest quickly, aggressively. I can't go. I can't go. I can't go. I don't want to go back. I whisper into his Adam's apple, blindly hoping that no one watching me in the simulation will hear. I want to stay here with you.
I'll be here, Iz, when you're ready.
He tilts my chin up towards his face. His jaw is clenched and I think I see tears gathering at the corners of his eyes.
But you have a life to live first.
I don't. I don't have a life.
Don't be silly.
And then, for a snippet of a moment, the decisive clip of scissors through a thread. Everything trembles. Yarrick is looking around him as if recovering his balance, and I know that he felt it too. And then it happens again, for longer. It's a silent scream that rips through the basement and my body fractures. It's like when I'm flicking through documents too quickly in my office and they judder as they struggle to catch up with the movement of my finger. Or when I look for the time in my eye lens when I'm jogging and it shifts awkwardly. Tremors convulse our world. And then it's back to how it was before.
What was that?
Asks Yarrick. And I see him trying to disguise his fear. He presses his hand against the wall. Just a glitch? It's a brave face I present him with. On the inside I wait for bricks to fall and dust to explode around us, but I hear nothing. It's gone again. I place my hand upon the door handle. And then I'm thrown to the ground. Instead of scraping the base of my hands against concrete slabs, I'm looking out over the azure sea in the Cinque Terre. It's a scene from my heaven I haven't experienced before. But it's not right. The view is beneath me, beneath my hands and knees, dropping away from where the floor should be. I'm suspended, as if on glass. It's all out of context, and I can smell cut grass invading my nostrils with the aggression of burning hair. I can see Yarrick is standing with his back flush against a wall, as if gravity is forcing him against it, as if he's on an accelerating roller coaster. I can almost see the distortion of the G-force in his cheeks. I look around me, and a door stands on its own in the center of the room, ajar. My cat, Juniper, lies on the vertical face of the door, and when she opens her mouth to mewl at me, what comes out is the soft rock music my mother and I used to dance to. I feel suddenly violently sick. "Yarrick! Yarrick!" I call, and his eyes meet mine. "Something's gone wrong!"
"Is it you? Because you've come in here?"
It stings like an accusation. But he seems to correct himself, stumbling over and crouching beside me, steadying himself with one hand. The veins at his neck and temples are engorged with blood. His eyes are wide and his mouth is pulled back as if with pain. "We need to try to move. Maybe this part of the heaven simulation is corrupted," I say. My thoughts try to catch up with my words. Something could have damaged this part of our neurons, I think, in the physical location in which our consciousness is currently active and connected. Maybe elsewhere in this cluster of neurons keeping me alive there is refuge.
"Okay, let's go."
Yarrick grabs my hand and helps me up. I struggle to connect my vision with thoughts and thoughts with actions. Leave. The door. What is a door? I look aimlessly at the different objects that are slipping in and out of my vision. I seem to stroke them with my fingertips before letting them float onward. One of these things is a door, but which one? And why do I need a door anyway? I might say these things, but I also might just think them. I can feel Yarrick shake me hard by the shoulders, but it doesn't reach me. I am numb and in pain simultaneously. I can't laugh or cry or scream or... I let him gather me in his arms and carry me up the stairs out of the basement. And then in the next moment we're running and the world is dying around us. A blur of colours and a cacophony of sounds ripple around my head. Everything is rich with texture. One moment it rubs lamb's wool soft on my neck, and the next it catches like needles. I look for the blackberry bushes, but they are not there. My emotions, too, are scattered. I veer from horror that pumps and spits in my veins to a discordant easiness, not quite contentment, more an absence of feeling, the quiet acceptance of dementia. There is no time for a panic attack.
"When do we stop?"
asks Yarrick without looking at me. Before I can reply, I see a mirage glimmering before us. It waits for us. It becomes our target. Around it the world takes shape. It's the literal light at the end of this tunnel. "Yarrick!" I point at it with my free hand and squint. It's the convertible. The paintwork gleams oyster. The doors are open and maybe, just maybe, that's the grumble of the engine I can hear. We rush ever closer. I see the highway stretching out beyond it and I feel my feet falling on tarmac. It swallows the sound of my fear. Yarrick grins at me, jubilant.
"Keep going,"
he says, although I'm not breathless. I know I should be, but I don't feel the physicality of it. It's an incomplete illusion. "You can drive," I say. My eye catches the sunlight reflecting off the silver backplate of the car, and as it hits my retina, the ground falls away. It's as if a chasm has opened in the middle of the road. It's like a photograph has been torn in two and then awkwardly pieced back together. In places, it sticks, it almost works, and in others, the two sides are so far apart as to be unrecognizable as the same image. I manage to pull myself to a halt only just in time, my toes teetering at the edge, my arms wheeling to keep my balance. There is no opportunity to scream or swear or exclaim. But Yarrick is heavier than me, and taller. The thrust behind his sprint is stronger and harder to stop. He keeps on going, and it's too late to change it. I watch as he plunges forward, and then feel myself falling again. He drops over the edge, if that's what it is or could be perceived to be, and pulls me down with him. But I'm behind him and I collapse into the road, my breasts crushing back into my ribcage and my chin hitting the ground. I expect to taste blood, but nothing comes. He's hanging, clinging on somehow, and he's screaming at me to hoist him back up. I can't see the lower half of his body. It has been sliced off in the darkness. He wants me to save him. I feel that I could, but I choose not to try. I let go, and I push myself up, folding my empty hands around my own neck as I listen to his fading scream. Chapter 23. I'm horizontal, and I'm shooting forwards feet first. White coats flutter alongside me. I hear screams, and I smell the metallic earthiness of blood. I'm inside, but the air I'm breathing isn't indoor air. It's laced with dirt and smoke and pavement. My eyes flicker shut. I open them again, and we're outside, definitely outside. I'm still moving, and Jess is beside me, walking quickly, but with a hand spread flat upon my chest. It's okay, she says. She repeats it over and over again, and I'm not sure if she's talking to me or talking to herself. The words run into each other, and in her Irish accent, it starts to sound like a song. There's shouting all around, and traffic thunders about us. The third time I come around, it's like waking up from a bad dream. Nausea rolls in my belly, and my lips feel dry and cracked. I don't open my eyes until I've composed myself. I remember my conversation with Yarrick. I remember the chasm and the visions I've just had. I expect the clean white sterility of the hospital room to confront me, but I am mistaken. I am somewhere else. My hand slips away from my abdomen and hits the floor. I'm lying on a sofa. Three people sit on chairs pulled into a semicircle around me. As I look at each of them in turn, I can see the relief on their faces. "Isabel!" one of the women exclaims. She drops forward onto her knees and places her hand upon my face. Her frizzy hair tickles my neck, and I resist the impulse to push her away. The other woman rises to stand over us and presses something cold against my chest, bringing a tube to her ear. There is a gash through the pale skin of her forehead, and her hair is dirtied with ash. The man they are with is silent. He sits forward on his chair, his fingers forming a bridge. His eyes leave my face and turn away to gaze out of the window at the greying sky. "Isabel, do you know who I am?" asks the woman who is standing up. She pushes my hair back from my face, and I feel her nails scratch the backs of my ears. It doesn't hurt, but I wince. I hear the man speak.
"Don't push her. It's too soon. We need her to rest,"
Yes, I say to myself. I need to rest. And I let my eyes fall shut. Darkness. Only shapes and outlines are visible. I'm covered in material which scratches at my neck, like the woman with the frizzy hair. Leela. That was Leela. I sense movement beside me and see it's the man. We are alone, it seems. He's sitting there with his elbows resting on his knees. He doesn't look like he's moved since I last saw him. The air smells stale, and I wonder how long I've been lying here. Maybe that smell is me. I don't know if he notices the half-opening of my eyes.
I'm so sorry,
he whispers, just loud enough for me to hear. I struggle to remember his name. The first thing I remember is that I don't trust him. Daniel, I murmur. I wish I could stay awake to watch him watch me, but I dissolve back into sleep.
You need to eat,
a female voice orders, and a spicy aroma wafts under my nose. I can feel my body being hauled up to a sitting position, and the soup is tipped towards me before I can respond. A warming tomato broth meets my lips. I take a few sips, and then the woman presses the mug into my hands. I look up at her. Jess. I think she must be able to tell that I recognize her because she breaks into a smile. A row of tiny stitches forms a bloody line above her eyebrow. Then she walks over to the window, and I observe her profile as she talks. She wriggles her small, upturned nose when she's thinking, I remember, and I watch for it. There was an explosion, she says. Chinese terrorists got into the hospital, I think. We thought we were safe down there, but part of the ceiling ruptured, and the rubble fell in, onto all my lab stuff. She glances over at me, and I nod for her to continue. That's what went wrong in your heaven, I mean. I think there was a tiny amount of physical damage to your mirror neurons. And then we had to work fast to get everything disconnected. She watches me, tipping her head to her shoulder. We had to get out of there, and I've never done it before, let alone done it so quickly. I was convinced that I damaged you permanently, but I think you're okay.
I feel all right. It sounds like you did well.
She nods a couple of times and starts to continue speaking, but is interrupted by the opening of the door. It's Daniel.
You can have a couple of minutes,
Jess says with irritation, pressing the back of her hand to the wound of her forehead. No more! She leaves the room and closes the door behind her. Daniel comes closer to me, pulling a chair with him, and sits down.
Where are we then? I ask. Valhalla's offices. Luckily everything is largely intact here. It was the best place we could think to come.
Where's Leela?
I am met with silence and the dropping of his gaze.
She's gone,
Daniel says.
She can't have gone already. I saw her earlier.
Daniel shakes his head and glances over at the door.
She was here. You were all here,
I say. There is more silence, and my words gather momentum in the vacuum.
She spoke to me, Daniel. She was here. Why can't you remember? I'm not imagining things. I'm not.
I think you might be, Isabel.
He pulls his chair forward and rests his hand on my forearm. I try to remember if that's the first time he's touched me. He feels warm, even through the shawl that covers me. I gape at him. I can't imagine what he means.
What happened in there?
He asks, frowning. He draws his hand away.
Why did you let Yarrick fall?
I
grasp at words. A I was expecting an answer, not a question.
I don't know. I don't know what happened, why it happened.
I pause. My mind is still heavy, and my thought processes are moving through treacle.
Oh, God, is he all right?
Yarrick's neurons sustained a similar level of damage to your own. A tiny area of physical corruption. But Jess thinks that they are pretty much intact, and like yours, the area may even heal. Jess will reinstate his heaven when she returns to London.
I think of him absolutely dead. Right now, he's not even in a simulation of life, and I feel desperately sad. I cradle the mug of hot soup against my heart. I didn't do the damage, did I, when I...
No.
And actually, by that point, your heavens had probably separated.
I think the chasm only appeared in your own heaven.
He pauses and sits back in his chair, folding his arms. When he speaks, his voice is lower, firmer. It searches through me.
I thought you loved him. I thought that's why you were doing all this.
Of course I loved him. I still do. How could you even ask me that?
Because I can't get my head around why you wouldn't have saved him. Why didn't you try to haul him back up? It doesn't make sense.
I was scared, I guess.
No,
he says, dipping his chin decisively.
No, you weren't.
He is in control, and I am stripped bare. He saw it all.
You just let go, he continues. Some people might call that psychopathic.
People like you mean?
It's the best comeback I can think of. I cannot believe that he's using this to make assumptions about my feelings for Yarrick. He raises his eyebrows and cocks his head by way of a response.
I've done what you wanted me to do, I say sullenly. And you saw what I saw. There was nothing, no hint, no clue that he hurt Sarah, or even wanted to.
Daniel remains still, pressing his index finger to his lips. He is waiting for me to say more. An uncomfortable sensation flickers through my chest, as I remember running along the clifftop in Yarrick's heaven, next to the faceless figure that I knew was Sarah. I recall the bitterness, the simmering anger that, having lived it, now almost feels like my own. And indeed, what I was seeing and experiencing was so confusing that perhaps that emotion was my own. Perhaps it was jealousy. That is the only thing I could tell Daniel that he might not have noticed from watching the simulation. But I don't voice it. It was only a feeling, after all. As my hesitation persists, there is a knock at the door and Jess reappears. The concern written across her face tells me that she has been standing right outside this whole time, listening.
That's it, Daniel. She needs to rest tonight.
She had been looking at me, but now she directs her gaze at him.
We all do.
He sighs and stands up, pulling his sleeves back from his wrists.
Wait. You never finished telling me where Leela is.
Daniel looks at Jess, and in that moment, I know. She's gone. Nausea crashes through me, and I press my hands to my mouth to keep it inside me. Jess walks over and sits beside me, slipping her arm around me. Leela's dead, Isabel. I'm so, so sorry.
No, no, no,
I mumble into my hand. I can feel the blood leave my face as I shake my head. She was hit by falling rubble on the way over here from the hospital.
It's my fault, I murmur. If I hadn't come here...
I think about our conversation outside my room last night. I was too tired to talk to her properly. I feel the lashing of guilt against the walls of my heart, and I know they will never heal over. It was her decision to come here, Izzy. No one else's.
It was supposed to be safe in that lab. Valhalla are meant to be looking after us.
I clamp my hands over my collarbone to quell the hiccup-like contractions that are spreading through my chest. All I can think is that I wish it had been me instead. It should have been me. It was over very quickly, Jess says, her voice growing quieter. We carried her body here, and Caleb is paying to have it repatriated privately tomorrow. And I have her mirror neurons intact, all ready to go. She will be in her heaven as soon as I can get back to London. What now? I ask myself. What now? Jess pulls me into her body and wraps her arms about me as I cry. I cry for a long, long time.
Chapter 24. I've dozed through a day and two nights, through nightmares and jagged awakenings. Jess keeps coming to check on me. She takes measurements and looks at readouts and holograms that pop up beside me. She pushes my eyelids apart and shines a bright light inside. She does this a lot, but she seems satisfied. Jess tries to make me smile, but all I can see when I look at her is Leela, and I feel like my lips might be broken forever, because I can only hold them closed and taut. My chip has marked me as safe on my social networks. I think my sister calls a couple of times, but Jess speaks to her. I watch the news a lot until the stinging in my temples sharpens into a shower of sparkling pain. Much of it is the global reaction to the drone strike here. It's strange to see it on my codex when I've lived through it, almost unaware. The scenes of smoking rubble and the remnants of clothes torn from victims at the point of impact seem a world away from here. Looking out of the window, you'd never know this building was in the same city in which close to 1,000 people have lost their lives, one of whom is Leela. All I can see are the formal gardens at the front of the offices, a large car park, and then Povai Lake beyond. Valhalla's offices face north, away from the carnage. In my waking moments, when I'm not fixated upon the latest broadcast or thinking about Leela, the smudge of her red lipstick, her conspiratorial laugh, or about her forgiveness, I imagine myself somewhere else. I can sometimes manage to sink into a daydream so deep that time starts to slip and slide, and I'm walking amongst blackberry bushes, hand in hand with Yarrick. But not now. Right now, I'm the most awake I've been since going under for the final procedure. It feels like months ago. I finger the metal studs in my scalp, just in case Jess has pulled them out in my sleep without me knowing. But they're still there, handcuffing me to an experience that fills me with the darkest emotions. It's a strange feeling to be inside an office, on a sofa, while the world is carrying on around me. But then, reality has lost its appeal. I feel like it's forever damaged, dirtied by the events which have enveloped me. I didn't think I was capable of more grief, but it turns out that I am. While before it hung like fog at the edges of my vision, now it consumes me like a physical force, weighing me down. A smoky grey silt appears to thread through everything in this room like a virus. It dampens down colour and scent. Even the nourishing soups and spicy curries that Jess tempts me with are losing their appeal. I push off the shawl that's wrapped tightly around me
and pull myself to my feet.
Sickness sloshes in my belly. Leaving the room, I trudge in the opposite direction to the toilet and in search of Jess. I listen for her voice, but this floor of the building seems completely deserted. I step into the elevator and drop down to the first floor. I stare at myself in the mirrored interior and wipe the smudges of mascara away from beneath my eyes. It doesn't shift. I lean closer and realize the silt is there too, lurking beneath my skin. The doors open and I seem to be in the functional part of the building. Men and women are waiting for the lift, and I walk past them into a small glass atrium that frames the lake. I feel their eyes upon me as I brush past. So, this is the greatest heaven architecture firm in the world. It certainly makes our clinic look like small fry. I know from the buttons inside the lift that there are four floors. Hundreds of people must work here. Large projections are displaying local news reports. A holographic Valhalla logo is suspended in midair in the center of the ceiling. The gilded gates that frame the company's title sit upon silvery clouds that seem to shift and swirl. The atrium is buzzing. Beyond the people milling back and forth, I spot the figure of Jess. I wonder whether it's her at first because she's not wearing her lab coat. She's wearing blue jeans and a navy shirt, and her hair is loose. She's leaning against the window, talking to someone on her codex, and she's twisting a curl of hair through her fingers. She doesn't see me approach until I slide my back up against the glass, raising my fingers in a small wave. Her mouth drops open in surprise, and she grips me by the shoulder. "Okay, darling," she says. "I'll see you soon. I love you." She rolls up her codex and slips it into her back pocket. "Izzy, what are you doing up? Are you okay?" "I want these gone." I gesture to the metal plugs in my scalp. "I know, I know. I want to take them out too, but Valhalla didn't want me to just yet." "Come on, Jess, screw them. Please. Can you do it now?" "I need the right equipment. I can't just yank them out. You'd hemorrhage all over the floor." I roll my eyes because I know she's exaggerating. "There, that's almost the Isabel I know and love." And I frown. Because why would she make such a throwaway comment? Who could possibly love me? I need to go back to my heaven. Not Yarrick's heaven, not some bizarre limbo between the two, but mine. The only place I have any control over. The only place that I will be able to be happy again. I'm done with this.
"Listen." Jess grabs my hand and pulls me closer to her. "Caleb is here."
"Caleb? What the hell?"
"I've no idea. He says he came to make sure Leela's body was repatriated properly, but I'm suspicious."
Her eyes dart around, beyond me, scanning the atrium. "What? You think he's come to murder me?" My sarcasm is barbed. I know I sound quarrelsome, but Jess seems to ignore it.
"Well, he's pissed off, certainly."
"But?" She pauses and twists her lips to one side of her mouth, shaking her head. "I know him. I know he's up to something." I study her face as she thinks, a gaze slipping off into the distance over the lake.
"If Caleb had ever hit me, I would have killed him. I would have scratched his eyes out.
At least, the old Isabel would have. This one would probably just shrug and walk away with blood dripping from her lip." I follow Jess's gaze out of the window and look down at the entrance area below. A gleaming red car pulls up, and Caleb steps out of the back seat. And out of the other side appears Daniel, wearing a suit jacket rather than his usual dark sweater. It makes him look taller. I watch him unbutton it as he walks around the back of the vehicle.
Jess!
I elbow her in the ribs and nod down at the car.
I didn't even know Daniel had left, she says, pursing her lips.
Jess is too magnanimous to hate Caleb, I think, whereas I would make it a defining point of my character. Perhaps part of her still loves him. But how could you love someone who'd done something as awful as that? We watch them enter the building together and disappear from view.
They'll be coming up here, she says. Come with me.
We move away from the window to the side of the atrium, where a few rows of benches and reading pods are clustered. The area is busy, and we sink down on a bench towards the back. I'm pleased to be sitting, because my chest is already tight from fatigue. Caleb and Daniel appear from the lift at the far side of the atrium and walk with purpose towards a petite, blonde woman. It's Maya. She goes with them, and together they swiftly disappear out of view. Jess rubs her finger over her lips for a few moments, deep in thought.
Come on.
She doesn't wait for me to follow her. She almost jogs across the floor, and I must move my heavy limbs quickly to keep up with her. As we turn into the corridor, the three of them are reaching its end, chatting animatedly. They turn right. Jess stops in her tracks.
Okay. They must be going into Maya's office. Let's give it a minute or two. Let me think.
And we stand there, awkwardly, in the middle of the corridor. Jess drums her fingers against the wall. A woman pushes past me, muttering something in Hindi. I blink away the automatic translation and move to lean against the wall. I feel quite drained, even from this small amount of activity.
We can try to get into the meeting room next door, Jess murmurs. We might be able to hear them from there.
Surely you don't want to spy on them? Jess pretends she hasn't heard me. We walk together to the end of the corridor and cautiously move around the corner. There's no sign of them.
In here,
Jess whispers, pointing at a door to our right. At that moment, it swings inwards and I gasp in surprise. People flood out, smiling and chatting, clutching tiny mugs containing dregs of chai. A meeting must have just finished. They flow past us, and we are forced back against the wall. A man in a suit is the last to leave, and he nods at us, pushing the door back so that it stays open behind him. Jess grants him a sparkling smile as we slip inside.
This is insane,
I whisper, as we sink down to the floor, our backs against the wall. Jess says nothing but shoots me a warning look. As the people disperse from outside the door, the room falls quiet and I start to hear the muffled murmur of voices. I glance at Jess and she nods, her brow furrowed in concentration.
That's them, she mouths and taps lightly on her ears. I want my stethoscope.
I smile and shrug. As the sounds from outside fade completely, their voices become clearer. We lean our heads against the wall, and I close my eyes in concentration.
She's always seemed fractious,
I hear Maya say.
She's threatened me before.
I can't hear what Daniel replies, but I can tell that it's definitely him and that he's asking a question.
To muddy Oakley's name, to make the business look bad, says Caleb.
I open my eyes and look at Jess, pointing a finger to my own chest.
Me?
Maya says something about a meeting, but I can't make her words out fully. She's talking about that meeting, about the single opt-in discussion when I first met her. Caleb interrupts her. His voice is deeper, it carries further through the wall.
And you'd never know where you were with her. In between all this, she'd always flirt with me. It was inappropriate at best, and I'm married.
It made me uncomfortable.
I nearly punched the wall in rage.